6. Lewis came back later feeling small. No one had asked him to examine Norma Crandall. When he crossed the street, Rudd, he reminded himself, smiling, the lady had already retired for the night. Judd was a vague silhouette behind the screens of the enclosed porch. There was the comfortable squeak of a rocker on old linoleum. Lewis knocked on the screen door, which rattled companionably against its frame. Crandall's cigarette glowed like a large, peaceable firefly in the summer darkness. From a radio, low, came the voice of a Red Sox game, and all of it gave Lewis Creed the honest feeling of coming home. "Doc," Crandall said, "I thought that was you." "I hope you've meant it about the beer," Lewis said, coming in. "Oh, about beer, I never lie," Crandall said. "A man who lies about beer makes enemies. Sit down, Doc. I put an extra couple on ice, just in case." The porch was long and narrow, furnished with rattan chairs and sofas. Lewis sank into one and was surprised at how comfortable it was. At his left hand was a tin pail filled with ice cubes and a few cans of Black Label. He took one. "Thank you," he said, and opened it. The first two swallows hit his throat like a blessing. "More'n welcome," Crandall said. "I hope your time here will be a happy one, Doc." "Amen," Lewis said. "Say, if you want crackers or something, I could get some. I got a wedge of rat that's just about ripe." "A wedge of what?" "Rat cheese," Crandall sounded faintly amused. "Thanks, but just the beer will do me." "Well then, we'll just let her go." Crandall belched contentedly. "Your wife gone to bed?" Lewis asked, wondering why he was opening the door like this. "Yeah. Sometimes she stays up. Sometimes she don't. Her arthritis is quite painful, isn't it?" "You ever see a case that wasn't?" Crandall asked. Lewis shook his head. "I guess it's tolerable," Crandall said. "She don't complain much. She's a good old girl, my Norma." There was a great and simple weight of affection in his voice. Out on Route 15, a tanker truck droned by, one so big and long that for a moment Lewis couldn't see his house across the road. Written on the side, just visible in the last light, was the word Orinco. "One hell of a big truck," Lewis commented. "Orinco's near Arrington," Crandall said. "Chemical fertilizer factory. They come and go all right. And the oil tankers, and the dump trucks, and the people who go to work in Bangor or Brewer and come home at night." He shook his head. "That's the one thing about Ludlow I don't like anymore. That frigging road. No peace from it. They go all day and all night. Wake Norma up sometimes. Hell, wake me up sometimes, and I sleep like a goddamn log." Lewis, who thought this strange main landscape almost eerily quiet after the constant roar of Chicago, only nodded his head. "One day soon the Arabs will pull the plug, and they'll be able to grow African violets right down the yellow line," Crandall said. "You might be right." Lewis tilted his can back and was surprised to find it empty. Crandall laughed. "You just grab yourself one to grow on, Doc." Lewis hesitated and then said, "All right, but just one more. I have to be getting back." "Sure you do." "Ain't moving a bitch." "It is," Lewis agreed. And then for a time they were silent. The silence was a comfortable one, as if they had known each other for a long time. This was a feeling about which Lewis had read in books, but which he had never experienced until now. He felt ashamed of his casual thoughts about free medical advice earlier. On the road, a semi roared by, its running lights twinkling like earth stars. "That's one mean road, all right," Crandall repeated thoughtfully, almost vaguely, and then turned to Lewis. There was a peculiar little smile on his seamed mouth. He poked a Chesterfield into one corner of the smile and popped a match with his thumbnail. "You remember the path there that your little girl commented on?" For a moment, Lewis didn't. Ellie had commented on a whole catalog of things before finally collapsing for the night. Then he did remember. That wide mown patch, winding up through the copse of trees and over the hill. "Yes, I do. You promised to tell her about it sometime." "I did, and I will," Crandall said. "That path goes up into the woods about a mile and a half. The local kids around Route 15 and Middle Drive keep it nice because they use it. Kids come and go. There's a lot more moving around than there used to be when I was a boy. Then you picked a place out and stuck to it. But they seem to tell each other, and every spring a bunch of them mows that path. They keep it nice all the summer long. Not all of the adults in town know it's there. A lot of them do, of course, but not all, not by a long chalk. But all of the kids do. I'd bet on it. Know what's there? The pet cemetery, Crandall said. Pet cemetery, Lewis repeated, bemused. It's not as odd as it probably sounds, Crandall said, smoking and rocking. It's the road. It uses up a lot of animals, that road does. Dogs and cats, mostly, but that ain't all. One of those big Orinco trucks run down the pet raccoon the Ryder children used to keep. That was back, Christ, must have been in 73, maybe earlier. Before the state made keeping a coon or even a denatured skunk illegal anyway. Why did they do that? Rabies, Crandall said. Lots of rabies in Maine now. There was a big old St. Bernard went rabid downstate a couple of years ago and killed four people. That was a hell of a thing. Dog hadn't had his shots. If those foolish people had seen that dog had had its shots, it never would have happened. But a coon or a skunk, you can vaccinate it twice a year and still it don't always take. But that coon the Ryder boys had, that was what the old-timers used to call a sweet coon. It'd waddle right up to you. Gory, wa'n't he fat. And lick your face like a dog. The dad even paid a vet to spay him and decloy him. That must have cost him a country fortune. Ryder, he worked for IBM in Bangor. They went out to Colorado 5 years ago. Or maybe it was six. Funny to think of those two almost old enough to drive. Were they broken up over that coon? I guess they were. Matty Ryder cried so long his mom got scared and wanted to take him to the doctor. I suppose he's over it now, but they never forget. When a good animal gets run down the road, a kid never forgets. Lewis's mind turned to Ellie, as he had last seen her tonight, fast asleep, with Church purring rustily on the foot of the mattress. My daughter's got a cat, he said. Winston Churchill. We call him Church for short. Do they climb when he walks? I beg your pardon. Lewis had no idea what he was talking about. He still got his balls, or has he been fixed? No, Lewis said. No, he hasn't been fixed. In fact, there'd been some trouble over that back in Chicago. Rachel had wanted to get Church spayed, but even made the appointment with the vet. Lewis canceled it. Even now, he wasn't really sure why. It wasn't anything as simple or as stupid as equating his masculinity with that of his daughter's Tom, nor even his resentment at the idea that Church would have to be castrated so the fat housewife next door wouldn't need to be troubled with twisting down the lids of her plastic garbage cans. Those things had been part of it, but most of it had been a vague but strong feeling that it would destroy something in Church that he himself valued, that it would put out the go-to-hell look in the cat's green eyes. Finally, he had pointed out to Rachel that they were moving to the country, and it shouldn't be a problem. Now, here was Judson Crandall pointing out that part of country living in Ludlow consisted of dealing with Route 15, and asked him if the cat was fixed. Try a little irony, Dr. Creed. It's good for your blood. I'd get him fixed, Crandall said, crushing his smoke between his thumb and forefinger. A fixed cat don't tend to wander as much. But if it's all the time crossing back and forth, its luck will run out, and it'll end up there with the Ryder kid's coon and little Timmy Dessler's cocker spaniel and Mrs. Bradley's parakeet. Not that the parakeet got run over in the road, you understand. It just went feet up one day. I'll take it under advisement, Lewis said. You do that, Crandall said, and stood up. How's that beer doing? I believe I'll go in for a slice of old Mr. Rat after all. Beer's gone, Lewis said, also standing, and I ought to go too. Big day tomorrow. Starting at the university? Lewis nodded. The kids don't come back for 2 weeks, but by then I ought to know what I'm doing, don't you think? Yeah. If you don't know where the pills are, I guess you'll have trouble. Crandall offered his hand, and Lewis shook it, mindful again of the fact that old bones pained easily. Come on over any evening, he said. Want you to meet my Norma. Think she'd enjoy you. I'll do that, Lewis said. Nice to meet you, Judd. Same goes both ways. You'll settle in. May even stay a while. I hope we do. Lewis walked down the crazy paved path to the shoulder of the road and had to pause while yet another truck, this one followed by a line of five cars headed in the direction of Bucksport, passed by. Then, raising his hand in a short salute, he crossed the street. Road, he reminded himself again, and let himself into his new house. It was quiet with the sounds of sleep. Kelly appeared not to have moved at all, and Gage was still in his crib, sleeping in typical Gage fashion, spread eagle on his back, a bottle within easy reach. Lewis paused there, looking in at his son, his heart abruptly filling with a love for the boy so strong that it seemed almost dangerous. He supposed part of it was simply homesickness for all the familiar Chicago places and Chicago faces that were now gone, erased so efficiently by the miles that they might never have been at all. There's a lot more moving around than there used to be. Used to be you picked a place out and stuck to it. There was some truth in that. He went to his son, and because there was no one there to see him do it, not even Rachel, he kissed his fingers and then pressed them lightly and briefly to Gage's cheek through the bars of the crib. Gage clucked and turned over on his side. "Sleep well, baby," Lewis said. He undressed quietly and slipped into his half of the double bed that was, for now, just a mattress on the floor. He felt the strain of the day beginning to pass. Rachel didn't stir. Unpacked boxes bulked ghostly in the room. Just before sleep, Lewis hiked himself up on one elbow and looked out the window. Their room was at the front of the house, and he could look across the road at the Crandall place. It was too dark to see shapes. On a moonlit night, it would not have been. But he could see the cigarette ember over there. Still up, he thought. He'll maybe be up for a long time. The old sleep poorly. Perhaps they stand watch. Against what? Lewis was thinking about that when he slipped into sleep. He dreamed he was in Disney World, driving a bright white van with a red cross on the side. Gage was beside him, and in the dream, Gage was at least 10 years old. Church was on the white van's dashboard, looking at Lewis with his bright green eyes, and out on Main Street, by the 1890s train station, Mickey Mouse was shaking hands with the children clustered around him, his big white cartoon gloves swallowing their small, trusting hands. 7. The next 2 weeks were busy ones for the family. Little by little, Lewis's new job began to shake down for him. How it would be when 10,000 students, many of them drug and liquor abusers, some afflicted with social diseases, some anxious about grades or depressed about leaving home for the first time, a dozen of them, girls mostly, anorexic, how it would be when all of them converged on the campus at once would be something else again. And while Lewis began getting a handle on his job as head of University Medical Services, Rachel began to get a handle on the house. Gage was busy taking the bumps and spills that went with getting used to his new environment, and for a while his nighttime schedule was badly out of whack, but by the middle of their second week in Ludlow, he began to sleep through again. Only Ellie, with the prospect of beginning kindergarten in a new place before her, seemed always overexcited and on a hair trigger. She was apt to go into prolonged giggling fits, or periods of almost menopausal depression, or temper tantrums at the drop of a word. Rachel, said Ellie, would get over it when she saw that school was not the great red devil she had made it out to be in her own mind. And Lewis thought Rachel was right. Most of the time, Ellie was what she had always been, a dear. His evening beer or two with Judd Crandall became something of a habit. Around the time Gage began sleeping through again, Lewis began bringing his own six-pack over every second or third night. He met Norma Crandall, a sweetly pleasant woman who had rheumatoid arthritis. Filthy, old rheumatoid arthritis, which kills so much of what could be good in the old ages of men and women who are otherwise healthy. But her attitude was good. She would not surrender to the pain. There would be no white flags. Let it take her if it could. Lewis thought she might have another 5 to 7 productive, if not terribly comfortable, years ahead of her. Going completely against his own established customs, he examined her at his own instigation, inventoried the prescriptions her own doctor had given her, and found them to be completely in order. He felt a nagging disappointment that there was nothing else he could do or suggest for her, but her, Dr. Weybridge, had things as under control as they were ever going to be for Norma Crandall, barring some sudden breakthrough, which was possible but not to be counted upon. You learned to accept, or you ended up in a small room writing letters home with Crayolas. Rachel liked her, and they had sealed their friendship by exchanging recipes, the way small boys trade baseball cards, beginning with Norma Crandall's deep dish apple pie for Rachel's beef stroganoff. Norma was taken with both of the Creed children, particularly with Ellie, who, she said, was going to be an old-time beauty. At least, Lewis told Rachel that night in bed, Norma hadn't said Ellie was going to grow into a real sweet coon. Rachel laughed so hard she broke explosive wind, and then both of them laughed so long and loudly that they woke up Gage in the next room. The first day of kindergarten arrived. Lewis, who felt pretty well in control of the infirmary and the medical support facilities now, took the day off. Besides, the infirmary was currently dead empty. The last patient, a summer student who had broken her leg on the student union steps, had been discharged a week before. He stood on the lawn beside Rachel with Gage in his arms as the big yellow bus made the turn from Middle Drive and lumbered to a stop in front of their house. The doors at the front folded open. The babble and squawk of many children drifted out on the mild September air. Ellie cast a strange, vulnerable glance back over her shoulder, as if to ask them if there might not yet be time to abort this inevitable process, and perhaps what she saw in the faces of her parents convinced her that the time was gone, and everything which would follow this first day was simply inevitable, like the progress of Norma Crandall's arthritis. She turned away from them and mounted the steps of the bus. The doors folded shut with a gasp of dragon's breath. The bus pulled away. Rachel burst into tears. "Don't, for Christ's sake," Lewis said. He wasn't crying. Only damn near. "It's only half a day." "Half a day is bad enough," Rachel answered in a scolding voice and began to cry harder. Lewis held her, and Gage slipped an arm comfortably around each parent's neck. When Rachel cried, Gage usually cried too, but not this time. "He has us to himself," Lewis thought, "and he damn well knows it." They waited with some trepidation for Ellie to return, drinking too much coffee, speculating on how it was going for her. Lewis went out into the back room that was going to be his study and messed about idly, moving papers from one place to another, but not doing much else. Rachel began lunch absurdly early. When the phone rang at 10:15, Rachel raced for it and answered with a breathless "hello" before it could ring a second time. Lewis stood in the doorway between his office and the kitchen, sure to be Ellie's teacher telling them that she had decided Ellie couldn't hack it. The stomach of public education had found her indigestible and was spitting her back. But it was only Norma Crandall calling to tell them that Judd had picked the last of the corn, and they were welcome to a dozen ears if they wanted it. Lewis went over with a shopping bag and scolded Judd for not letting him help pick it. "Most of it ain't worth a tin shit anyway," Judd said. "You'll kindly spare that talk while I'm around," Norma said. She came out on the porch with iced tea on an antique Coca-Cola tray. "Sorry, my love." "He ain't sorry a bit," Norma said to Lewis and sat down with a wince. "Saw Ellie get on the bus," Judd said, lighting a Chesterfield. "She'll be fine," Norma said. "They almost always are." Almost, Lewis thought morbidly. But Ellie was fine. She came home at noon, smiling and sunny, her blue first day of school dress belling gracefully around her scabbed shins. And there was a new scrape on one knee to marvel over. A picture of what might have been two children, or perhaps two walking gantries, in one hand, one shoe untied, one ribbon missing from her hair, shouting, "We sang Old MacDonald, Mommy! Daddy, we sang Old MacDonald! Same one as in the Carstairs Street School!" Rachel glanced over at Lewis, who was sitting in the window seat with Gage on his lap. The baby was almost asleep. There was something sad in Rachel's glance, and although she looked away quickly, Lewis felt a moment of terrible panic. "We're really going to get old," he thought. "It's really true. No one's going to make an exception for us. She's on her way, and so are we." Ellie ran over to him, trying to show him her picture, her new scrape, and tell him about Old MacDonald and Mrs. Berryman, all at the same time. Church was twining in and out between her legs, purring loudly, and Ellie was somehow, almost miraculously, not tripping over him. "Shh," Lewis said and kissed her. Gage had gone to sleep, unmindful of all the excitement. "Just let me put the baby to bed, and then I'll listen to everything." He took Gage up the stairs, walking through hot, slanting September sunshine, and as he reached the landing, such a premonition of horror and darkness struck him that he stopped cold, and looked around in surprise, wondering what could possibly have come over him. He held the baby tighter, almost clutching him, and Gage stirred uncomfortably. Luce's arms and back had broken out in great rashes of goose flesh. "What's wrong?" he wondered, confused and frightened. His heart was racing. His scalp felt cool and abruptly too small to cover his skull. He could feel the surge of adrenaline behind his eyes. Human eyes really did bug out when fear was extreme, he knew. They did not just widen, but actually bulged as blood pressure climbed and the hydrostatic pressure of the cranial fluids increased. What the hell is it? Ghosts? Christ, it really feels as if something just brushed by me in this hallway, something I almost saw. Downstairs, the screen door whacked against its frame. Lewis Creed jumped, almost screamed, and then laughed. It was simply one of those psychological cold pockets people sometimes pass through, no more, no less. A momentary fugue. They happen, that was all. What had Scrooge said to the ghost of Jacob Marley? "You may be no more than an underdone bit of potato. There's more gravy than grave to you." And that was more correct, physiologically as well as psychologically, than Charles Dickens had probably known. There were no ghosts, at least not in his experience. He had pronounced 24 people dead in his career, and had never once felt the passage of a soul. He took Gage into his room and laid him in his crib. As he pulled the blanket up over his son, though, a shudder twisted up his back, and he thought suddenly of his Uncle Carl's showroom. No new cars there, no televisions with all the modern features, no dishwashers with glass fronts so you could watch the magical sudsing action. Only boxes with their lids up, a carefully hidden spotlight over each. His father's brother was an undertaker. Good God, what gave you the horrors? Let it go. Dump it. He kissed his son and went down to listen to Ellie tell about her first day at the big kids' school. 8. That Saturday, after Ellie had completed her first week of school and just before the college kids came back to campus, Judd Crandall came across the road and walked over to where the Creed family sat on their lawn. Ellie had gotten off her bike and was drinking a glass of iced tea. Gage was crawling in the grass, examining bugs, perhaps even eating a few. Gage was not particular where his protein came from. "Judd," Lewis said, getting up, "let me get you a chair." "No need." Judd was wearing jeans, an open-throated work shirt, and a pair of green boots. He looked at Ellie. "You still want to see where yon path goes, Ellie?" "Yes," Ellie said, getting up immediately. Her eyes sparkled. "George Buck at school told me it was the pet cemetery, and I told Mommy, but she said to wait for you because you knew where it was." "I do, too," Judd said. "If it's okay with your folks, we'll take us a stroll up there. You'll want a pair of boots, though. Ground's a bit squishy in places." Ellie rushed into the house. Judd looked after her with amused affection. "Maybe you'd like to come too, Lewis." "I would," Lewis said. He looked at Rachel. "You want to come, honey?" "What about Gage?" "I thought it was a mile." "I'll put him in the jerry pack." Rachel laughed. "Okay. But it's your back, mister." They started off 10 minutes later, all of them but Gage wearing boots. Gage was sitting up in the jerry pack and looking at everything over Lewis's shoulder, goggle-eyed. Ellie ranged ahead constantly, chasing butterflies and picking flowers. The grass in the backfield was almost waist-high, and now there was goldenrod, that late-summer gossip which comes to tattle on autumn every year. But there was no autumn in the air today. Today the sun was still all August, although calendar August was almost 2 weeks gone. By the time they had reached the top of the first hill, walking strung out along the mown path, there were big patches of sweat under Lewis's arms. Judd paused. At first Lewis thought it might be because the old man was winded. Then he saw the view that had opened out behind them. "Pretty up here," Judd said, putting a piece of timothy grass between his teeth. Lewis thought he had just heard the quintessential Yankee understatement. "It's gorgeous," Rachel breathed, and then turned to Lewis, almost accusingly. "How come you didn't tell me about this?" "Because I didn't know it was here," Lewis said, and was a little ashamed. They were still on their own property. He had just never found time to climb the hill in back of the house until today. Ellie had been a good way ahead. Now she came back, also gazing with frank wonder. Church padded at her heels. The hill was not a high one, but it did not need to be. To the east, Heavy woods blocked any view, but looking this way, west, the land fell away in a golden and dozy late summer dream. Everything was still, hazed, silent. There was not even an Orinco tanker on the highway to break the quiet. It was the river valley they were looking into, of course. The Penobscot, where loggers had once floated their timber from the northeast down to Bangor and Derry. But they were south of Bangor and a bit north of Derry here. The river flowed wide and peacefully, as if in its own deep dream. Lewis could make out Hampton and Winterport on the far side, and over here he fancied he could trace the black river-paralleling snake of Route 15 nearly all the way to Bucksport. They looked over the river, its lush hem of trees, the roads, the fields. The spire of the North Ludlow Baptist Church poked through one canopy of old elms, and to the right he could see the square brick sturdiness of Ellie's school. Overhead, white clouds moved slowly toward a horizon the color of faded denim, and everywhere were the late summer fields, used up at the end of the cycle, dormant but not dead, an incredible tawny color. "Gorgeous is the right word," Lewis said finally. "They used to call it Prospect Hill back in the old days," Judd said. He put a cigarette in the corner of his mouth, but did not light it. "There's a few that still do, but now that younger people have moved into town, it's mostly been forgot. I don't think there's very many people that even come up here. It don't look like you could see much because the hill's not very high. But you can see..." He gestured with one hand and fell silent. "You can see everything," Rachel said in a low, awed voice. She turned to Lewis. "Honey, do we own this?" And before Lewis could answer, Judd said, "It's part of the property, oh yes." Which wasn't, Lewis thought, quite the same thing. It was cooler in the woods, perhaps by as much as 8 or 10 degrees, the path still wide and occasionally marked with flowers in pots or in coffee cans, most of them wilted, was now floored with dry pine needles. They had gone about a quarter of a mile, moving downhill now, when Judd called Ellie back. "This is a good walk for a little girl," Judd said kindly, "but I want you to promise your mom and dad that if you come up here, you'll always stay on the path." "I promise," Ellie said promptly. "Why?" He glanced at Lewis, who had stopped to rest. Toting Gage, even in the shade of these old pines and spruces, was heavy work. "Do you know where you are?" Judd asked Lewis. Lewis considered and rejected answers. "Ludlow. North Ludlow. Behind my house. Between Route 15 and Middle Drive." He shook his head. Judd jerked a thumb back over his shoulder. "Plenty of stuff that way," he said. "That's town. This way, nothing but woods for 50 miles or more. The North Ludlow Woods, they call it here. But it hits a little corner of Orrington, then goes over to Rockford. Ends up going onto those state lands I told you about. The ones the Indians want back. I know it sounds funny to say you're a nice little house there on the main road, with its phone and electric lights and cable TV and all, is on the edge of a wilderness. But it is." He looked back at Ellie. "All I'm saying is that you don't ought to get messing around in these woods, Ellie. You might lose the path, and God knows where you might end up then." "I won't, Mr. Crandall." Ellie was suitably impressed, even awed, but not afraid, Lewis saw. Rachel, however, was looking at Judd uneasily, and Lewis felt a little uneasy himself. It was, he supposed, the city-bred's almost instinctive fear of the woods. Lewis hadn't held a compass in his hand since Boy Scouts, 20 years before, and his memories of how to find your way by things like the North Star, or which side of the trees moss grew on, were as vague as his memories of how to tie a sheep shank or a half-hitch. Judd looked them over and smiled a little. "Now, we ain't lost nobody in these woods since 1934, he said. "At least nobody local. The last one was Will Jepson. No great loss, except for Stanny Bouchard, I guess. Will was the biggest tosspot this side of Bucksport." "You said nobody local," Rachel remarked in a voice that was not quite casual, and Lewis could almost read her mind. "We're not local. At least not yet." Judd paused, and then nodded. "We do lose one of the tourists every 2 or 3 years because they think you can't get lost right off the main road. But we never lost even one of them for good, missus. Don't you fret." Are there moose? Rachel asked apprehensively, and Lewis smiled. If Rachel wanted to fret, she would jolly well fret. Well, you might see a moose, Judd said. But he wouldn't give you any trouble, Rachel. During mating season, they get a little irritated, but otherwise they do no more than look. Only people they take after out of their rutting time are people from Massachusetts. I don't know why that's so, but it is. Lewis thought the man was joking, but could not be sure. Judd looked utterly serious. I've seen it time and time again. Some fellow from Saugus or Milton or Weston up a tree, yelling about a herd of moose. Every damn one of them as big as a motorhome. Seems like moose can smell Massachusetts on a man or a woman. Or maybe it's just all those new clothes from L.L. Bean's they smell. I don't know. I'd like to see one of those animal husbandry students from the college do a paper on it. But I suppose none ever will. What's rutting time? Ellie asked. Never mind, Rachel said. I don't want you up here unless you're with a grown-up, Ellie. Rachel moved a step closer to Lewis. Judd looked pained. I didn't want to scare you, Rachel. You or your daughter. No need to be scared in these woods. This is a good path. It gets a little buggy in the spring, and it's a little sloppy all the time, except for 55, which was the driest summer I can remember. But, hell, there isn't even any poison ivy or poison oak, which there is at the back of the schoolyard. And you want to stay away from it, Ellie, if you don't want to spend 3 weeks of your life taking starch baths. Ellie covered her mouth and giggled. It's a safe path, Judd said earnestly to Rachel, who still didn't look convinced. Well, I bet even Gage could follow it. And the town kids come up here a lot. I already told you that. They keep it nice. Nobody tells them to. They just do it. I wouldn't want to spoil that for Ellie. He bent over her and winked. It's like many other things in life, Ellie. You keep on the path and all's well. You get off it, and the next thing you know, you're lost if you're not lucky. And then someone has to send out a searching party. They walked on. Lewis began to get a dull cramp of pain in his back from the baby carrier. Every now and then Gage would grab a double handful of his hair and tug enthusiastically, or administer a cheerful kick to Lewis's kidneys. Late mosquitoes cruised around his face and neck, making their eye-watering hum. The path curved down, bending in and out between very old firs, and then cut widely through a brambly, tangled patch of undergrowth. The going was soupy here, and Lewis's boots squelched in mud and some standing water. At one point, they stepped over a marshy spot, using a pair of good-sized tussocks as stepping stones. That was the worst of it. They started to climb again, and the trees reasserted themselves. Gage seemed to have magically put on 10 pounds, and the day had, with some similar magic, warmed up 10 degrees. Sweat poured down Lewis's face. "How you doing, hon?" Rachel asked. "Want me to carry him for a while?" "No, I'm fine," he said. And it was true, although his heart was larruping along at a good speed in his chest. He was more used to prescribing physical exercise than he was to doing it. Judd was walking with Ellie by his side. Her lemon-yellow slacks and red blouse were bright splashes of color in the shady brown-green gloom. "Lou, does he really know where he's going, do you think?" Rachel asked in a low, slightly worried tone. "Sure," Lewis said. Judd called back cheerily over his shoulder. "Not much farther now. You bearing up, Lewis?" My God, Lewis thought. The man's well past 80, but I don't think he's even broken a sweat. "I'm fine," he called back a little aggressively. Pride probably would have led him to say the same thing, even if he had felt the onset of a coronary. He grinned, hitched the straps of the jerry pack up a bit, and went on. They topped the second hill, and then the path sloped through a head-high swatch of bushes and tangled underbrush. It narrowed, and then, just ahead, Lewis saw Ellie and Judd go under an arch made of old, weather-stained boards. Written on these, in faded black paint, only just legible, were the words, "Pet Cemetery," S-E-M-A-T-A-R-Y. He and Rachel exchanged an amused glance and stepped under the arch, instinctively reaching out and grasping each other's hands as they did so, as if they had come here to be married. For the second time that morning, Lewis was surprised into wonder. There was no carpet of needles here. Here was an almost perfect circle of mown grass, perhaps as large as 40 feet in diameter. It was bounded by thickly interlaced underbrush on three sides, and an old blowdown on the fourth, a jackstraw jumble of fallen trees that looked both sinister and dangerous. A man trying to pick his way through that, or to climb over it, would do well to put on a steel jock, Lewis thought. The clearing was crowded with markers, obviously made by children from whatever materials they could beg or borrow. The slats of crates, scrap wood, pieces of beaten tin. And yet, seen against the perimeter of low bushes and straggly trees that fought for living space and sunlight here, the very fact of their clumsy manufacture and the fact that humans were responsible for what was here seemed to emphasize what symmetry they had. The forested backdrop lent the place a crazy sort of profundity, a charm that was not Christian, but pagan. "It's lovely," Rachel said, not sounding as if she meant it. "Wow!" Ellie cried. Lewis unshouldered Gage and pulled him out of the baby carrier so he could crawl. Lewis's back sighed with relief. Ellie ran from one monument to the next, exclaiming over each. Lewis followed her while Rachel kept an eye on the baby. Judd sat down cross-legged, his back against a protruding rock, and smoked. Lewis noticed that the place did not just seem to have a sense of order, a pattern. The memorials had been arranged in rough concentric circles. "Smucky the cat," one crate board marker proclaimed. The hand was childish but careful. "He was obedient." And below this, 1971 to 1974. A little way around the outer circle, he came to a piece of natural slate with a name written on it in fading but perfectly legible red paint. "Biffer." And below this, a bit of verse. "Biffer, Biffer, a hell of a sniffer. Until he died, he made us richer." Biffer was the Dessler's Cocker Spaniel, Judd said. He had dug a bald place in the earth with the heel of his shoe and was carefully tapping all his ashes into it. "Got run over by a dumpster last year. Ain't that some poem?" "It is," Lewis agreed. Some of the graves were marked with flowers, some fresh, most old, not a few almost totally decomposed. Over half of the painted and pencil inscriptions that Lewis tried to read had faded away to partial or total illegibility. Others bore no discernible mark at all, and Lewis guessed that the writing on these might have been done with chalk or crayon. "Mom," Ellie yelled, "here's a goldfishy. Come and see." "I'll pass," Rachel said, and Lewis glanced at her. She was standing by herself, outside the outermost circle, looking more uncomfortable than ever. Lewis thought, even here she's upset. She never had been easy around the appearances of death. Not, he supposed, that anyone really was, probably because of her sister. Rachel's sister had died very young, and it had left a scar which Lewis had learned early in their marriage not to touch. Her name had been Zelda, and her death had been from spinal meningitis. Her mortal illness had probably been long and painful and ugly, and Rachel would have been at an impressionable age. If she wanted to forget it, he thought there could be no harm in that. Lewis tipped her a wink, and Rachel smiled gratefully at him. Lewis looked up. They were in a natural clearing. He supposed that explained how well the grass did. The sun could get through. Nevertheless, it would have taken watering and careful tending. That meant cans of water lugged up here, or maybe Indian pumps, even heavier than Gage and his jerry pack carried on small backs. He thought again that it was an odd thing for children to have kept up for so long. His own memory of childhood enthusiasms, reinforced by his dealings with Ellie, was that they tended to burn like newsprint, fast, hot, and quick to die. Moving inward, the pet graves became older. Fewer and fewer of the inscriptions could be read, but those that could yielded a rough timeline extending into the past. Here was Trixie, kilt on the highway, September 15, 1968. In the same circle was a wide, flat board planted deep in the earth. Frost and thaw had warped it and canted it to one side, but Lewis could still make out, "In memory of Marta, our pet rabbit, died March 1, 1965. A row farther in was, "General Patton, our good dog," the inscription amplified, who had died in 1958. And Polynesia, who would have been a parrot if Lewis remembered his Dr. Doolittle correctly, who had squawked her last Polly Want a Cracker in the summer of 1953. There was nothing readable in the next two rows, and then, still a long way in from the center, chiseled roughly on a piece of sandstone was Hannah, the best dog that ever lived, 1929 to 1939. Although sandstone was relatively soft, as a result the inscription was now little more than a ghost, Lewis found it hard to conceive of the hours some child must have spent impressing those nine words on the stone. The commitment of love and grief seemed to him staggering. This was something parents did not even do for their own parents or for their children if they died young. "Boy, this does go back some," he said to Judd, who had strolled over to join him. Judd nodded. "Come here, Lewis. I want to show you something." They walked to a row only three back from the center. Here the circular pattern, perceived as an almost haphazard coincidence in the outer rows, was very evident. Judd stopped before a small piece of slate that had fallen over. Kneeling carefully, the old man set it up again. "Used to be words here," Judd said. "I chiseled them myself, but it's worn away now. I buried my first dog here, Spot. He died of old age in 1914, the year the Great War began." Bemused by the thought that here was a graveyard that went farther back than many graveyards for people, Lewis walked toward the center and examined several of the markers. None of them were readable, and most had been almost reclaimed by the forest floor. The grass had almost entirely overgrown one, and when he set it back up, there was a small, tearing, protesting sound from the earth. Blind beetles scurried over the section he had exposed. He felt a small chill and thought, "Boot Hill for animals. I'm not sure I really like it." "How far do these go back?" "Gorry, I don't know," Judd said, putting his hands deep in his pockets. "Place was here when Spot died, of course. I had a whole gang of friends in those days. They helped me dig the hole for Spot. Digging here ain't that easy, either. Ground's awful stony, you know, hard to turn. And I helped them sometimes." He pointed here and there with a horny finger. "That there was Pete Levasseur's dog, if I remember right. And there's three of Albion Grotley's barn cats buried right in a row there. Old man Fritchie kept racing pigeons. Me and Al Grotley and Carl Hanna buried one of them that a dog got. He's right there." He paused thoughtfully. "I'm the last of that bunch left, you know. All dead now, my gang. All gone." Lewis said nothing, only stood looking at the pet graves with his hands in his pockets. "Ground's stony," Judd repeated. "Couldn't plant nothing here but corpses anyway, I guess." Across the way, Gage began to cry thinly, and Rachel brought him over, toting him on her hip. "He's hungry," she said. "I think we ought to go back, Lou." "Please, okay?" her eyes asked. "Sure," he said. He shouldered the jerry pack again and turned around so Rachel could pop Gage in. "Ellie! Hey, Ellie, where are you?" "There she is," Rachel said and pointed toward the blowdown. Ellie was climbing as if the blowdown was a bastard cousin to the monkey bars at school. "Oh, honey, you want to come down off there?" Judd called over, alarmed. "You stick your foot in the wrong hole and those old trees shift. You'll break your ankle." Ellie jumped down. "Ow!" she cried and came toward them, rubbing her hip. The skin wasn't broken, but a stiff, dead branch had torn her slacks. "You see what I mean?" Judd said, ruffling her hair. "Well, blow down like this, even someone wise about the woods won't try to climb over it if he can go around. Trees that all fall down in a pile get mean. They'll bite you if they can." "Really?" Ellie asked. "Really. They're piled up like straws, you see. And if you was to step on the right one, they might all come down in an avalanche." Ellie looked at Lewis. "Is that true, Daddy?"
"I think so, hon."
"Yuck." She looked back at the blowdown and yelled, "You tore my pants, you cruddy trees." All three of the grown-ups laughed. The blowdown did not. It merely sat whitening in the sun, as it had done for decades. To Lewis, it looked like the skeletal remains of some long-dead monster, something slain by a parfait good and gentle knight, perchance. A dragon's bones, left here in a giant cairn. It occurred to him, even then, that there was something too convenient about that blowdown, and the way it stood between the pet cemetery and the depths of woods beyond. Woods which Judd Crandall later sometimes referred to absently as the Indian Woods. Its very randomness seemed too artful, too perfect for a work of nature. It... Then Gage grabbed one of his ears and twisted it, crowing happily, and Lois forgot all about the blowdown in the woods beyond the pet cemetery. It was time to go home.
9. Ellie came to him the next day looking troubled. Lois was working on a model in his study. This one was a 1917 Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost, 680 pieces, over 50 moving parts. It was nearly done, and he could almost imagine the liveried chauffeur, direct descendant of 18th and 19th century English coachmen, sitting imperially behind the wheel. He'd been model crazy since his 10th year.
He had begun with a World War I Spad that his Uncle Carl had bought him, had worked his way through most of the Ravel airplanes, and had moved on to bigger and better things in his teens and 20s.
There had been a boats and bottles phase, and a war machines phase, and even a phase in which he had built guns so realistic it was hard to believe they wouldn't fire when you pulled the trigger. Colts and Winchesters and Lugers, even a Buntline special. Over the last 5 years or so, it had been the big cruise ships, a model of the Lusitania, and one of the Titanic set on his shelves at his university office. And the Andrea Doria, completed just before they left Chicago, was currently cruising the mantelpiece in their living room. Now he had moved on to classic cars, and if previous patterns held true, he supposed it would be 4 or 5 years before the urge to do something new struck him. Rachel looked on this, his only real hobby, with a wifely indulgence that held, he supposed, some elements of contempt. Even after 10 years of marriage, she probably thought he would grow out of it. Perhaps some of this attitude came from her father, who believed just as much now as at the time Lewis and Rachel had married that he had gotten an asshole for a son-in-law. Maybe, he thought, Rachel is right. Maybe I'll just wake up one morning at the age of 37, put all these models up in the attic and take up hang gliding. Meanwhile, Ellie looked serious. Far away, drifting in the clear air, he could hear that perfect Sunday morning sound of church bells calling worshippers. Hi, Dad, she said.
Hello, Pumpkin.
What's happening?
Oh, nothing, she said.
But her face said differently. Her face said that plenty was up, and none of it was so hot, thank you very much. Her hair was freshly washed and fell loose to her shoulders. In this light, it was still more blonde than the brown it was inevitably becoming. She was wearing a dress, and it occurred to Lewis that his daughter almost always put on a dress on Sundays, although they did not attend church. What are you building? Carefully gluing on a mud guard, he told her. Look at this, he said, carefully handing her a hubcap. See those linked R's? That's a nice detail, huh? If we fly back to Chi-Town for Thanksgiving, and we get on an L-1011, you look out at the jet engines and you'll see those same R's. Hubcap, big deal. She handed it back. Please, he said. If you own a Rolls-Royce, you call that a wheel covering. If you're rich enough to own a Rolls, you can strut a little. When I make my second million, I'm going to buy myself one. Rolls-Royce Corniche. And when Gage gets carsick, he can throw up under real leather. And just by the way, Ellie, what's on your mind? But it didn't work that way with Ellie. You didn't ask things right out. She was wary of giving too much of herself away. It was a trait Lewis admired.
Are we rich, Daddy?
No, he said. But we're not going away to starve either.
Michael Burns at school says all doctors are rich.
Well, you tell Michael Burns at school that lots of doctors get rich, but it takes 20 years. And you don't get rich running a university infirmary. You get rich being a specialist, a gynecologist, or an orthopedist, or a neurologist. They get rich quicker. For utility infielders like me, it takes longer.
Then why don't you be a specialist, Daddy?
Lewis thought of his models again, and of the way he had one day just not wanted to build any more warplanes. The way he had likewise gotten tired of Tiger tanks and gun emplacements. The way he had come to believe, almost overnight, it seemed in retrospect, that building boats in bottles was pretty dumb. And then he thought of what it would be like to spend your whole life inspecting children's feet for hammer toe, or putting on the thin latex gloves so you could grope along some woman's vaginal canal with one educated finger feeling for bumps or lesions. I just wouldn't like it, he said. Church came into the office, paused, inspected the situation with his bright green eyes. He leaped silently under the windowsill and appeared to go to sleep. Ellie glanced at him and frowned, which struck Lewis as exceedingly odd. Usually Ellie looked at Church with an expression of love so sappy it was almost painful. She began to walk around the office, looking at various models, and in a voice that was nearly casual, she said, "Boy, there were a lot of graves up in the pet cemetery, weren't there?" "Ah, here's the nub," Lewis thought, but did not look around. After examining his instructions, he began putting the carriage lamps on the rolls. "There were," he said. "Better than 100, I'd say."
"Daddy, why don't pets live as long as people?"
"Well, some animals do live about as long," he said. "And some live much longer. Elephants live a very long time. And there are some sea turtles so old that people really don't know how old they are. Or maybe they do, and they just can't believe it." Ellie dismissed these simply enough.
"Elephants and sea turtles aren't pets. Pets don't live very long at all. Michael Burns says that every year a dog lives, it's like 9 of our years."
"7, Lewis corrected automatically. "I see what you're getting at, honey. And there's some truth to it. A dog who lives to be 12 is an old dog. See, there's this thing called metabolism. And what metabolism seems to do is tell time. Oh, it does other stuff, too. Some people can eat a lot and stay thin because of their metabolism, like your mother. Other people, me for instance, just can't eat as much without getting fat. Our metabolisms are different, that's all. But what metabolism seems to do most of all is to serve living things as a body clock. Dogs have a fairly rapid metabolism. The metabolism of human beings is much slower. We live to be about 72, most of us, and believe me, 72 years is a very long time." Because Ellie looked really worried, he hoped he sounded more sincere than he actually felt. He was 35, and it seemed to him that those years had passed as quickly and ephemerally as a momentary draft under a door. "Sea turtles now have an even slower metabolism. What about cats?" Ellie asked and looked at Church again.
"Well, cats live as long as dogs," he said. "Mostly, anyway."
This was a lie, and he knew it. Cats lived violent lives and often died bloody deaths, always just below the usual range of human sight. Here was Church, dozing in the sun, or appearing to. Church, who slept peacefully on his daughter's bed every night. Church had been so cute as a kitten, all tangled up in a ball of string. Yet Lewis had seen him stalk a bird with a broken wing, his green eyes sparkling with curiosity and, yes, Lewis would have sworn it, cold delight. He rarely killed what he stalked, but there had been one notable exception, a large rat probably caught in the alley between their apartment house and the next. Church had really put the blocks to that baby. It had been so bloody and gore-flecked that Rachel, then in her 6th month with Gage, had had to run into the bathroom and vomit. Violent lives, violent deaths. A dog got them and ripped them open instead of just chasing them like the bumbling, easily fooled dogs on the TV cartoons. Or another Tom got them. Or a poisoned bait. Or a passing car. Cats were the gangsters of the animal world, living outside the law and often dying there. There were a great many of them who never grew old by the fire. But those are maybe not things to tell your 5-year-old daughter, who was for the first time examining the facts of death. "I mean," he said, "Church is only 3 now, and you're 5. You might still be alive when you're 15, a sophomore in high school, but that's a long time away."
"It doesn't seem long to me,"
Ellie said, and now her voice trembled. "Not long at all." Lewis gave up the pretense of working on his model and gestured for her to come. She sat on his lap, and he was again struck by her beauty, which was emphasized now by her emotional upset. She was dark-skinned, almost Levantine. Tony Benton, one of the doctors he had worked with in Chicago, used to call her the Indian Princess. "Honey," he said, "if it was up to me, I'd let Church live to be 100. But I don't make the rules."
"Who does?"
she asked. And then, with infinite scorn,
"God, I suppose."
Lewis stifled the urge to laugh. It was too serious.
"God or somebody," he said.
"Clocks run down. That's all I know. There are no guarantees, babe." I don't want church to be like all those dead pets," she burst out, suddenly tearful and furious. "I don't want church to ever be dead. He's my cat. He's not God's cat. Let God have his own cat. Let God have all the damn old cats he wants and kill them all. Church is mine."
There were footsteps across the kitchen, and Rachel looked in, startled. Ellie was now weeping against Lewis's chest. The horror had been articulated. It was out. Its face had been drawn and could be regarded. Now, even if it could not be changed, it could at least be wept over. "Ellie," he said, rocking her. "Ellie, Ellie, church isn't dead. He's right over there, sleeping."
"But he could be," she wept. "He could be any time."
He held her and rocked her, believing, rightly or wrongly, that Ellie wept for the very intractability of death, its imperviousness to argument or to a little girl's tears, that she wept over its cruel unpredictability, and that she wept because of the human being's wonderful, deadly ability to translate symbols into conclusions that were either fine and noble or blackly terrifying. If all those animals had died and been buried, then church could die any time and be buried. And if that could happen to church, it could happen to her mother, her father, her baby brother, to herself. Death was a vague idea. The pet cemetery was real. In the texture of those rude markers were truths which even a child's hands could feel. It would be easy to lie at this point, the way he had lied earlier about the life expectancy of tomcats. But a lie would be remembered later and perhaps finally totted up on the report card all children hand into themselves on their parents. His own mother had told him such a lie, an innocuous one about women finding babies in the dewy grass when they really wanted them. And as innocuous as the lie had been, Lewis had never forgiven his mother for telling it, or himself for believing it. "Honey," he said, "it happens. It's a part of life." "It's a bad part," she cried. "It's a really bad part." There was no answer for this. She wept. Eventually her tears would stop. It was a necessary first step on the way to making an uneasy peace with a truth that was never going to go away. He held his daughter and listened to church bells on Sunday morning floating across the September fields. And it was some time after her tears had stopped before he realized that, like church, she had gone to sleep. He put her up in her bed and then came downstairs to the kitchen where Rachel was beating cake batter too hard. He mentioned his surprise that Ellie should just cork off like that in the middle of the morning. It wasn't like her. "No," Rachel said, setting the bowl down the counter with a decisive thump. "It isn't. But I think she was awake most of last night. I heard her tossing around, and Church cried to go out around 3. He only does that when she's restless."
"Why would she?"
"Oh, you know why," Rachel said angrily. "That damned pet cemetery is why. It really upset her, Lou. It was the first cemetery of any kind for her, and it just upset her. I don't think I'll write your friend Judd Crandall any thank you notes for that little hike."
All at once he's my friend, Lewis thought, bemused and distressed at the same time.
"Rachel, and I don't want her going up there again."
"Rachel, what Judd said about the path is true. It's not the path, and you know it," Rachel said.
She picked up the bowl again and began beating the cake batter even faster.
"It's that damned place. It's unhealthy. Kids going up there and tending the graves, keeping the path. Fucking morbid is what it is. Whatever disease the kids in this town have got, I don't want Ellie to catch it."
Lewis stared at her, nonplussed. He more than half suspected that one of the things which had kept their marriage together, when it seemed as if each year brought the news that 2 or 3 of their friends' marriages had collapsed, was their respect of the mystery, the half-grasped but never-spoken idea that maybe, when you got right down to the place where the cheese binds, there was no such thing as marriage, no such thing as union, that each soul stood alone and ultimately defied rationality. That was the mystery. And no matter how well you thought you knew your partner, you occasionally ran into blank walls or fell into pits. And sometimes, rarely, thank God, you ran into a full-fledged pocket of alien strangeness, something like the clear air turbulence that can buffet an airline for no reason at all. An attitude or belief which you had never suspected, one so peculiar, at least to you, that it seemed nearly psychotic. And then you trod lightly, if you valued your marriage and your peace of mind. You tried to remember that anger at such a discovery
was the province of fools who really believed it was possible for one mind to know another. "Honey, it's just a pet cemetery," he said. "The way she was crying in there just now," Rachel said, gesturing toward the door to his office with a batter-covered spoon. "Do you think it's just a pet cemetery to her? It's going to leave a scar, Lou." "No, she's not going up there anymore. It's not the path, it's the place. Here she is already thinking church is going to die." For a moment, Lewis had the crazy impression that he was still talking to Ellie. She had simply donned stilts, one of her mother's dresses, and a very clever, very realistic Rachel mask. Even the expression was the same, set and a bit sullen on top, but wounded beneath. He groped because suddenly the issue seemed large to him, not a thing to be simply passed over in deference to that mystery or that aloneness. He groped because it seemed to him that she was missing something so large it nearly filled the landscape. And you couldn't do that unless you were deliberately closing your eyes to it. "Rachel," he said, "church is going to die." She stared at him angrily. "That is hardly the point," she said, enunciating each word carefully, speaking as one might speak to a backward child. "Church is not going to die today or tomorrow." "I tried to tell her that. Or the day after that. Or probably for years." "Honey, we can't be sure of that." "Of course we can," she shouted. "We take good care of him. He's not going to die. No one is going to die around here. And so why do you want to go and get a little girl all upset about something she can't understand until she's much older?" "Rachel, listen." But Rachel had no intention of listening. She was blazing. "It's bad enough to try and cope with a death, a pet or a friend or a relative, when it happens without turning it into a goddamn tourist attraction, a forest lawn for animals." Tears were running down her cheeks. "Rachel," he said, and tried to put his hands on her shoulders. She shrugged them off in a quick, hard gesture. "Never mind," she said. "You don't have the slightest idea what I'm talking about." He sighed. "I feel like I fell through a hidden trapdoor and into a giant mixmaster," he said, hoping for a smile. He got none. Only her eyes, locked on his, black and blazing. She was furious, he realized. Not just angry, but absolutely furious. "Rachel," he said suddenly, not fully sure what he was going to say until it was out, "how did you sleep last night?" "Oh, boy," she said scornfully, turning away, but not before he had seen a wounded flicker in her eyes. "That's really intelligent. Really intelligent. You never change, Lewis. When something isn't going right, blame Rachel, right? Rachel's just having one of her weird emotional reactions." "That's not fair." "No." She took the bowl of cake batter over to the far counter by the stove and set it down with another bang. She began to grease a cake tin, her lips pressed tightly together. He said patiently, "There's nothing wrong with a child finding out something about death, Rachel. In fact, I'd call it a necessary thing. Ellie's reaction, her crying, that seemed perfectly natural to me. It sounded natural," Rachel said, whirling on him again. "It sounded very natural to hear her weeping her heart out over her cat, which is perfectly fine." "Stop it," he said. "You're not making any sense. I don't want to discuss it anymore." "Yes, but we're going to," he said, angry himself now. "You had your at-bats. How about giving me mine?" "She's not going up there anymore, and as far as I'm concerned, the subject is closed." "Ellie has known where babies come from since last year," Lewis said deliberately. "We got her the Myers book and talked to her about it. Do you remember that? We both agreed that children ought to know where they come from." "That has nothing to do with it, does though," he said roughly. "And I was talking to her in my office about church. I got thinking about my mother, and how she spun me that old cabbage leaf story when I asked her where women got babies. I've never forgotten that lie. I don't think children ever forget the lies their parents tell them." "Where babies come from has nothing to do with a goddamn pet cemetery," Rachel cried at him. And what her eyes said to him was, "Talk about the parallels all night and all day, if you want to, Lewis. Talk until you turn blue, but I won't accept it." Still, he tried. "She knows about babies. That place up in the woods just made her want to know something about the other end of things. It's perfectly natural. In fact, I think it's the most natural thing in the..." "Would you stop saying that?" she screamed suddenly. Really screamed. And Lewis recoiled, startled. His elbow struck the open bag of flour on the counter. It tumbled off the edge and struck the floor, splitting open. Flour puffed up in a dry, white cloud. "Oh, fuck," he said dismally. In an upstairs room, Gage began to cry. "That's nice," she said, also crying now. "You woke the baby up, too. Thanks for a nice, quiet, stressless Sunday morning." She started by him, and Lewis put a hand on her arm. "Let me ask you something," he said. "Because I know that anything, literally anything, can happen to physical beings. As a doctor, I know that. Do you want to be the one to explain to her what happens if her cat gets distemper or leukemia? Cats are very prone to leukemia, you know. Or if he gets run over in that road? Do you want to be the one, Rachel?" "Let me go," she nearly hissed. The anger in her voice, however, was overmatched by the hurt and bewildered terror in her eyes. "I don't want to talk about this, Lewis, and you can't make me," that look said. "Let me go. I want to get to Gage before he falls out of his crib, because maybe you ought to be the one," he said. "You can tell her we don't talk about it. Nice people don't talk about it. They just bury it. Oops. But don't say buried. You'll give her a complex." "I hate you," Rachel sobbed and tore away from him. Then he was, of course, sorry. And it was, of course, too late. "Rachel." She pushed by him roughly, crying harder. "Leave me alone. You've done enough." She paused in the kitchen doorway, turning toward him, the tears coursing down her cheeks. "I don't want this discussed in front of Ellie anymore, Lou. I mean it. There's nothing natural about death. Nothing. You as a doctor should know that." She whirled and was gone, leaving Lewis in the empty kitchen, which still vibrated with their voices. At last he went to the pantry to get the broom. As he swept, he reflected on the last thing she had said and on the enormity of this difference of opinion, which had gone undiscovered for so long. Because as a doctor he knew that death was, except perhaps for childbirth, the most natural thing in the world. Taxes were not so sure. Human conflicts were not. The conflicts of society were not. Boom and bust were not. In the end, there was only the clock and the markers, which became eroded and nameless in the passage of time. Even sea turtles and the giant sequoias had to buy out someday. "Zelda," he said aloud. "Christ, that must have been bad for her." The question was, should he just let it ride, or should he try to do something about it? He tilted the dustpan over the wastebasket, and flour slid out with a soft foom, powdering the cast-out cartons and used-up cans. 10. "Hope Ellie didn't take it too hard," Judd Crandall said. Not for the first time, Lewis thought that the man had a peculiar and rather uncomfortable ability to put his finger gently on whatever the sore spot was. He and Judd and Norma Crandall now sat on the Crandall's porch in the cool of the evening, drinking iced tea instead of beer. On 15, going home after the weekend traffic was fairly heavy. People recognized that every good late summer weekend now might be the last one, Lewis supposed. Tomorrow he took up his full duties at the University of Maine Infirmary. All day yesterday and today, students had been arriving, filling apartments in Orono and dorms on campus, making beds, renewing acquaintances, and no doubt groaning over another year of 8 o'clock classes and commons food. Rachel had been cool to him all day. No, freezing was more like it. And when he went back across the road tonight, he knew that she would already be in bed, Gage sleeping with her, more than likely, the two of them so far over to her side that the baby would be in danger of falling off. His half of the bed would have grown to three quarters, all of it looking like a big, sterile desert. "I said I hope..." "Sorry," Lewis said. "Wool gathering. She was a little upset. Yeah. How did you guess that?" "Seen him come and go, like I said." Judd took his wife's hand gently and grinned at her. "Haven't we, dear?" "Packs and packs of them," Norma Crandall said. "We love the children. Sometimes that pet cemetery is their first eyeball to eyeball with death," Judd said. "They see people die on TV, but they know that's pretend. Like the old westerns they used to have at the movies on Saturday afternoons. On TV and in the western movies, they just hold their stomachs over their chests and fall over.
place up on that hill seems a lot more real to most of them than all those movies and TV shows put together, don't you know?
Lewis nodded, thinking, tell my wife that, why don't you?
Some kids it don't affect at all, at least not so you can see it, although I guess most of them kind of take it home in their pockets to look over later, like all the other stuff they collect. Most of them are fine. But some... You remember the little Holloway boy, Norma?
She nodded. Ice chattered softly in the glass she held. Her glasses hung on her chest, and the headlights of a passing car illuminated the chain briefly.
He had such nightmares, she said. Dreams about corpses coming out of the ground, and I don't know what all. Then his dog died. Ate some poison bait was all anyone in town could figure, wasn't it, Judd?
Poison bait, Judd said, nodding.
That's what most people thought, eh? That was 1925. Billy Holloway was maybe 10 then. Went on to become a state senator. Ran for the U.S. House of Representatives later on, but he lost. That was just before Korea. He and some of his friends had a funeral for the dog, Norma remembered. It was just a mongrel, but he loved it well. I remember his parents were a little against the burying because of the bad dreams and all, but it went off fine. Two of the bigger boys made a coffin, didn't they, Judd?
Judd nodded and drained his iced tea.
Dean and Dana Hall, he said. Them and that other kid Billy chummed with. I can't remember his first name, but I'm sure he was one of the Bowie kids. You remember the Bowies used to live up on Middle Drive in the old Bruchette house, Norma?
Yes, Norma said, as excited as if it had happened yesterday. And perhaps in her mind it seemed that way.
It was a boy, Alan or Bert, or maybe it was Kendall,
Judd agreed.
Anyways, I remember they had a pretty good argument about who was going to be pallbearers. The dog wasn't very big, so there wasn't room but for two. The Hall boys said they ought to be the ones to do it, since they made the coffin, and also because they were twins, sort of a matched set, you see. Billy said they didn't know Bowser, that was the dog, well enough to be the pallbearers. My dad says only close friends get to be pallbearers, was his argument. Not just any carpenter.
Judd and Norma both laughed at this, and Lewis grinned.
They was just about ready to fight over it when Mandy Holloway, Billy's sister, fetched out the fourth volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica, Judd said. Her dad, Stephen Holloway, was the only doctor this side of Bangor, and that side of Bucksport in those days, Lewis. And they was the only family in Ludlow that could afford a set of encyclopedia.
They were also the first to have electric lights, Norma broke in.
Anyway, Judd resumed, Mandy came out all a-flukin', head up and tail over the splashboard, all of 8 years old, petticoats flying, that big book in her arms. Billy and the Bowie kid, I think it must have been Kendall, him that crashed and burned up in Pensacola where they was training fighter pilots in early 1942. They was getting ready to take on the Hall twins over the privilege of toting that poor old poison mutt up to the boneyard.
Lewis started giggling. Soon he was laughing out loud. He could feel the days-old residue of tension left from the bitter argument with Rachel beginning to loosen.
So she says, wait, wait, look at this. And they all stop and look. And goddamn if she ain't...
Judd, Norma said warningly.
Sorry, dear. I get carried away, yarning. You know that.
I guess you do, she said.
And darned if she ain't got that book open to funerals. And there's a picture of Queen Victoria getting her final send-off and bon voyage. And there are about 11 people on each side of her coffin, some sweating and straining to lift the bugger, some just standing around in their funeral coats and ruffled collars like they was waiting for someone to call post-time at the racetrack. And Mandy says, when it's a ceremonial funeral of state, you can have as many as you want. The book says so.
That solved it? Lewis asked.
That did the trick. They ended up with about 20 kids. And damn if they didn't look just like the picture Mandy had found, except maybe for the ruffles and tall hats. Mandy took charge, she did. Got them lined up and gave each of them a wildflower, a dandelion or a lady slipper or a daisy, and off they went.
By the gee, I always thought the country missed a bet when Mandy Holloway never got voted to the U.S. Congress.
He laughed and shook his head.
Anyway, that was the end of Billy's bad dreams about the pet cemetery. He mourned his dog and finished his mourning and got on. Which is what we all do, I guess.
Lewis thought again of Rachel's near hysteria.
Your Ellie will get over it, Norma said and shifted position. You must be thinking that death is all we talk about around here, Lewis.
Judd and I are getting on, but I hope neither of us has gotten to the Gorkrow stage yet.
No, of course not. Don't be silly, Lewis said. But it's not such a bad idea to be a nodding acquaintance with it. These days, I don't know, no one wants to talk about it, or think about it seems. They took it off the TV because they thought it might hurt the children some way, hurt their minds. And people want closed coffins so they don't have to look at the remains or say goodbye. It just seems like people want to forget it.
And at the same time, they brought in the cable TV with all those movies showing people...
Judd looked at Norma and cleared his throat. Showing people doing what people usually do with their shades pulled down, he finished. Crea, how things change from one generation to the next, isn't it?
Yes, Lewis said. I suppose it is.
Well, we come from a different time, Judd said, sounding almost apologetic. We was in closer terms with death. We saw the flu epidemic after the Great War. And mothers dying with child. And children dying of infection and fevers that it seems like doctors just wave a magic wand over these days. In the time when me and Norma was young, if you got cancer, why, that was your death warrant right there. No radiation treatments back in the 1920s. Two wars, murders, suicides.
He fell silent for a moment.
We knew it as a friend and as an enemy, he said finally. My brother Pete died of a burst appendix in 1912, back when Taft was president. Pete was just 14, and he could hit a baseball farther than any kid in town. In those days, you didn't need to take a course in college to study death, hot spice, or whatever they call it. In those days, it came into the house and said howdy, and sometimes it took supper with you, and sometimes you could feel it bite your ass.
This time, Norma didn't correct him and said she nodded silently. Lewis stood up, stretched.
I have to go, he said. Big day tomorrow. Yes, the merry-go-round starts up for you tomorrow, don't it?
Judd said, also standing.
Judd saw Norma, who was also trying to get up, and gave her a hand. She rose with a grimace.
Bad tonight, is it? Lewis asked.
Not so bad, she said.
Put some heat on it when you go to bed.
I will, Norma said. I always do.
And Lewis,
don't fret about Ellie. She'll be too busy getting to know her new friends this fall to worry much about that old place. Maybe someday all of them will go up and repaint some of the signs or pull weeds or plant flowers. Sometimes they do when the notion takes them. And she'll feel better about it. She'll start to get that nodding acquaintance.
Not if my wife has anything to say about it.
Come on over tomorrow night and tell me how it went up at the college if you get the chance, Judd said. I'll whoop you at cribbage.
Well, maybe I'll get you drunk first, Lewis said. Double skunk you.
Doc, Judd said with great sincerity, the day I get double skunked at cribbage would be the day I'd let a quack like you treat me.
He left on their laughter and crossed the road to his own house in the late summer dark. Rachel was sleeping with the baby, curled up on her side of the bed in a fetal protective position. He supposed she would get over it. There had been other arguments and times of coldness in their marriage, but this one was surely the worst of the lot. He felt sad and angry and unhappy all at the same time, wanting to make it up but not sure how, not even sure that the first move should come from him. It was all so pointless. Only a cap full of wind, somehow blown up to hurricane proportions by a trick of the mind. Other fights and arguments, yes, sure, but only a few as bitter as the one over Ellie's tears and questions. He supposed it didn't take a great many blows like that before the marriage sustained structural damage. And then one day, instead of reading about it in a note from a friend,
Well, I suppose I ought to tell you before you hear it from someone else, Lou. Maggie and I are splitting. Or in the newspaper. It was you. He undressed to his shorts quietly and set the alarm for 6 a.m. Then he showered, washed his hair, shaved, and crunched up a Rolaid before brushing his teeth. Norma's iced tea had given him acid indigestion. Or maybe it was coming home and seeing Rachel way over on her side of the bed. Territory is that which defines all else. Hadn't he read that in some college history course? Everything done, the evening put neatly away, he went to bed. But couldn't sleep. There was something else, something that nagged at him. The last 2 days went around and around in his head as he listened to Rachel and Gage breathing nearly in tandem. General Patton. Hannah, the best dog that ever lived. Marta, our pet rabbit. Ellie, furious. I don't want Church to ever be dead. He's not God's cat. Let God have his own cat. Rachel, equally furious. You as a doctor should know. Norma Crandall saying, it just seems like people want to forget it. And Judd, his voice terribly sure, terribly certain, the voice from another age. Sometimes it took supper with you, and sometimes you could feel it bite your ass. And that voice merged with the voice of his mother, who had lied to Lewis Creed about sex at 4, but told him the truth about death at 12, when his cousin Ruthie had been killed in a stupid car accident. She'd been crushed in her father's car by a kid who had found the keys in a public works department payloader and decided to take it for a cruise and then found out he didn't know how to stop it. The kid suffered only minor cuts and contusions. His Uncle Carl's Fairlane was demolished. She can't be dead, he had replied in answer to his mother's bald statement. He had heard the words, but he couldn't seem to get the sense of them. What do you mean she's dead? What are you talking about? And then, as an afterthought, who's going to bury her? For although Ruthie's father, Lewis's uncle, was an undertaker, he couldn't imagine that Uncle Carl would possibly be the one to do it. In his confusion and mounting fear, he had seized upon this as the most important question. It was a genuine conundrum, like who cut the town barber's hair. I imagine that Donnie Donahue will do it, his mother replied. Her eyes were red-rimmed. Most of all, she had looked tired. His mother had looked almost ill with weariness. He's your uncle's best pal in the business. All but Lewis. Sweet little Ruthie. I can't stand to think she suffered. Pray with me, will you, Lewis? Pray with me for Ruthie. I need you to help me. So they had gotten down on their knees in the kitchen, he and his mother, and they prayed. And it was the praying that finally brought it home to him. If his mother was praying for Ruthie Creed's soul, then it meant that her body was gone. Before his closed eyes rose a terrible image of Ruthie coming to his 13th birthday party with her decaying eyeballs hanging on her cheeks and blue mold growing in her red hair, and this image provoked not just sickening horror, but an awful, doomed love. He cried out in the greatest mental agony of his life, she can't be dead. Mama, she can't be dead. I love her. And his mother's reply, her voice flat and yet full of images, dead fields under a November sky, scattered rose petals, brown and turning up at the edges, empty pools scummed with algae, rot, decomposition, dust. She is, my darling. I'm sorry, but she is. Ruthie is gone. Lewis shuddered, thinking, dead is dead. What else do you need? Suddenly Lewis knew what it was he had forgotten to do, why he was still awake on this night before the first day of his new job, hashing over old griefs. He got up, headed for the stairs, and suddenly detoured down the hall to Ellie's room. She was sleeping peacefully, mouth open, wearing her blue baby doll pajamas that she had really outgrown. My God, Ellie, he thought, you're sprouting like corn. Church lay between her splayed ankles, also dead to the world. You should pardon the pun. Downstairs, there was a bulletin board on the wall by the phone with various messages, memos, and bills tacked to it. Written across the top in Rachel's neat caps was, things to put off as long as possible.
Lewis got the telephone book, looked up a number, and jotted it on a blank memo sheet. Below the number, he wrote, Quentin J. Jolander, DVM. Call for appointment, re-church. If Jolander doesn't neuter animals, he will refer. He looked at the note, wondering if it was time, knowing that it was. Something concrete had to come out of all this bad feeling, and he had decided sometime between this morning and tonight, without even knowing he was deciding, that he didn't want church crossing the road anymore if he could help it. His old feelings on the subject rose up in him, the idea that neutering would lessen the cat, would turn him into a fat old Tom before his time, content to just sleep on the radiator until someone put something into his dish. He didn't want church like that. He liked church the way he was, lean and mean. Outside in the dark, a big semi droned by on Route 15, and that decided him. He tacked the memo up and went to bed.